I'm going to talk about two big trends in American life over the last 50 or 60 years, the decline of institutional Christianity and the growing polarization of our politics.
Ross Douthat of the New York Times talking about his presentation at the 2019 Issues Etc. Making the Case conference.
The increasingly strident division between an ideological left and an ideological right. And I'm going to argue that Christianity has weakened precisely because people have become more likely to identify with ideologies than with religious beliefs, and that a recovered Christianity, a more robust public religious faith, is actually an answer to polarization because it gives people an identity that's bigger than partisanship, so they can define themselves as Christians first and liberals or conservatives second.
You can meet and hear Ross Douthat at the Issues Etc. Making the Case conference, June 7th and 8th in Chicago. Learn more at issuesetc.org.
Thank you. I'm honored to be here with leaders from across the country and all around the world who are all united by a shared belief in the glory of God and the power of prayer.
I believe that God is love, which is more accurate than saying that love is God. God is the epitome of love. He defines what love is.
No, not so, dear brother. I did not point you down that path so that baptism should grant the liberty to sin. Quite the opposite.
To stray from God's created order and God's created design then becomes a direct attack on the triune God of love in whose image we are made.
Southern Illinois bird watchers love Issues, etc.
In 2003, Philip Jenkins wrote a book on anti-Catholicism, and the subtitle of the book was The Last Acceptable Prejudice. He made the argument that it is woven into American society and it persists. Why does anti-Catholicism persist? Why can we see, say, a Roman Catholic woman who is being examined for a nomination and appointment to a federal judiciary questioned about her Catholic beliefs when there, in our Constitution, is supposed to be no religious test for public office? And is anti-Catholicism the same thing as anti-Christianity? How have prominent Roman Catholics dealt with persistent anti-Catholicism? Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. live on this Monday afternoon, May the 6th. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. We're going to talk about that persistence of anti-Catholicism in America. Dr. Corey Moss of Hillsdale College will be our guest. Then an hour or two of Issues Etc. We will respond to your email and your comments on the Issues Etc. listener comment line. Joining us to talk about the persistence of anti-Catholicism in America, Dr. Corey Moss, Assistant Professor of History at Hillsdale College, author of a recent column for the Public Discourse titled The Coming Anti-Catholicism. Dr. Moss, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thank you for having me.
You write, politics in the United States has, from the nation's founding, been vexed by the question of Catholicism. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, for those of us who tend to think of, you know, the founding of America having to do with things like the First Amendment and religious liberty, it's difficult to recall and understand how contentious that kind of question was. You know, we remember that people like the Puritans and the Pilgrims from England came over because they wanted the religious freedom to practice as they were not allowed to in England. But of course, one of their concerns in England was that the Church of England still remained too Catholic by their lights. And so, in some respects, they were coming to America to avoid what they considered the problems of Catholicism, both theologically and politically. And so, as we move closer to the actual founding, the Revolution, the Declaration of Independence, one of the things, it's a small thing, but it's a telling thing, that is specifically mentioned as sparking the colonists to arm themselves is not simply taxes on tea or paper or anything like that, but that the government of the United Kingdom had recognized Catholicism as a legitimate religion in Canada. And that was very troubling to many colonists, that they were attempting to escape Anglicanism, which they thought too Catholic, never mind full-blown Catholicism. And now the government that had not recognized their religious liberty was recognizing the religious liberty and rights of Catholics right next door.
So can you give us some examples of how anti-Catholicism in America remains America's, it's often called, last socially acceptable prejudice?
Yeah, frankly, I'm not convinced that anti-Catholicism is the last acceptable prejudice. I think that that's the kind of thing that one often hears, and there is some warrant for that. So, for example, probably most recently and most recognizably, the case against the Little Sisters of the Poor with respect to the Affordable Care Act. You know, the idea that the coercive power of the state would require a bunch of elderly nuns to cover contraception in their insurance struck many people as ridiculous, but it also struck many people as in some way intentionally targeting the Catholic community. So that's a good example of the kind of thing that might raise the specter of anti-Catholicism. I mean, of course, on a broader reflection, we realize that it was not only Catholics who had problems with the Affordable Care Act, and so there were a number of lawsuits filed by evangelical corporations, including Hobby Lobby and others. So, I mean, to some extent, what is often construed as anti-Catholicism is anti-Christianity, or at least anti-certain tenets of Christianity. And I suppose to the extent that the Catholic Church does remain the world's largest church and in some ways the most visible and gets the most attention in the media, it's sometimes easy to conflate the two.
There was a peculiar incident with the, I believe it was the confirmation hearings for Amy Coney Barrett to the United States Circuit Court. In her hearings, her religious beliefs, and oddly, something that was not really intrinsically Roman Catholic about her beliefs came into question. But then there was this famous line delivered by one of the senators, "The dogma lives loudly within you." What did that tell you about if anti-Catholicism, or maybe just more generally, as you mentioned, anti-Christianity?
Yeah, that's right. And that particular quotation got a lot of airplay, I think largely because so many people were shocked by it. This is not the kind of thing we're used to hearing in the 21st century, or in fact through most of the latter half of the 20th century, that in a public forum, with respect to a public office, someone's dogma or someone's theology would be singled out for questioning. Implied, but less often explicitly noted in the press coverage, was that not only was Coney Barrett told, the dogma lives loudly within you, but the comment went on to specify this is a concern. So it is a stark indication that the public discourse has changed a little bit and that there is an increasing willingness to single out religious belief as potentially disqualifying.
So how is anti-Catholicism today different from anti-Catholicism in the past?
Yeah, that's a good question, and it kind of goes to the earlier point I made that anti-Catholicism is sometimes conflated with anti-Christianity more broadly. In the early parts of our American history, well, and not just the early, even up until the 1960s when John F. Kennedy was running for president, it was largely Protestants, and especially the more fundamentalist Protestants, who might have been legitimately described as anti-Catholic. Now, a lot of fundamentalist Protestants might still be considered anti-Catholic, but where we hear most of the criticism of Catholicism coming from today are from people who don't identify as Christian or perhaps religious in any sense, but identify as secular or nuns in the social scientific terminology, and who are politically progressive. And so when they think of Christianity, and perhaps Catholicism especially, they're thinking in terms of what are the teachings of that church with respect to my agenda for the sexual revolution, or immigration, or whatever the political question of the day might be. And they kind of identify Catholicism or Christianity in terms of a political agenda less than in terms of ideology. So the main difference, I would say, is that those who are today described as anti-Catholic tends to be secular and progressive, whereas in earlier days, anti-Catholicism seemed more to be the preserve of serious conservative, even fundamentalist Protestants.
You mentioned President Kennedy, and it is a kind of jarring to think that his Catholicism was a big issue when he was not only running for Senate, but then later for president. How have prominent Catholics like Kennedy attempted to deal with anti-Catholicism in the past?
Yeah, Kennedy kind of set the template for this because he knew it was an issue. He knew that he had to respond to it in some way. And the way he chose to respond to it was by making what we might think of as a public-private distinction. And so he explained in a series of interviews and in a very famous public address in 1960 that whatever his religious beliefs, those were a private matter. And in his public life, holding public office, he would not be guided by the theology of his church or by the temporal head of his church, the Pope, but would be guided by the public documents of the Constitution and the laws of the land, which was comforting to a lot of people because there was this prejudice and this animus against Catholics because there was a belief that a Catholic, since he has to be obedient to the Pope, if a Catholic was given political power, especially that of the president, the executive officer of the United States, that he would, in some sense, be a puppet of this foreign power, both temporal and spiritual, in Rome. And Kennedy tried to assure them that that was not the case, that his private and spiritual life was subject to the dictates of the church, but in public office, he would strictly abide by the Constitution and American law.
How did that response to anti-Catholicism in some way leave the impression that anti-Catholicism was fading away, might be a thing of the past?
Partly on account of Kennedy's assassination, but not only on account of that. Kennedy's press has been glowing ever since. I mean, it's very easy to say, look, we've had a Catholic president. He was a great president. And therefore, all of these fears about, some sort of Catholic coup were obviously, the fever dreams of radical fundamentalists. And we've seen it, and it did not pan out as predicted by anti-Catholics. And so we don't need to worry about that anymore. And that was in some ways confirmed, or seemed to be confirmed, because also in the 1960s, the Second Vatican Council of the Catholic Church seemed very much to be a liberalizing phenomenon. And so there, at that Second Vatican Council, for example, a very important document on religious liberty was promulgated, which seems to say that it is the official position of the Catholic Church that religious liberty is a fundamental human right, and that therefore the kind of coercion, prohibitions on public worship by Protestants, prohibitions on evangelism by Protestants, or even back to the Middle Ages, burning Protestants at the stake, none of that is ever going to happen again because we as a church have denounced it and have instead insisted that religious liberty is a fundamental right to be protected by all. And so, between those two things, in some ways, glamour and success of the Kennedy presidency, along with the church itself seeming to have turned a corner, made people realize that, okay, some of the crazy propaganda of the 19th century can be forgotten. Catholics aren't who we thought they were.
We're talking with Dr. Corey Maas about the persistence of anti-Catholicism in America. When we come back, a quote that says, in part, it is not bigotry to question whether someone is ill-suited for high office on account of his beliefs. Who said it, and why is it important? Stay tuned. Are you looking for a first communion, confirmation, or graduation gift? The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for May is the new bonded leather cover edition of Luther's Small and Large Catechisms. You can browse before you buy at issuesetc.org or call Concordia Publishing House 1-800-325-3040 and request the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for May, Martin Luther's Small and Large Catechisms, 1-800-325-3040.
Throughout the 50 days of Easter, sacred music for the world. LutheranPublicRadio.org. Listen 24/7 to sacred music for the Easter season. LPR, LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Many Lutheran pastors outside of the U.S. receive little or no seminary education. Luther Academy provides theological triage through conferences, books, and journals. Help support Luther Academy by making a tax-deductible donation at lutheracademy.com or call 260-452-2211. Serving Lutheran pastors to the ends of the earth, Luther Academy, 260-452-2211 or lutheracademy.com.
Looking for a foreign language program that will revolutionize your students' vocabulary knowledge and their understanding of grammar? How about a program that teaches critical thinking skills too? Look no further than Memoria Press's Latin curriculum. Students of all ages can use these Latin study programs. Give your students the gift of Latin today. To order, visit memoriapress.com and save $5 on your next order by using the coupon code LPR9. Memoria Press, saving Western civilization one student at a time.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking with Dr. Corey Moss of Hillsdale College about the persistence of anti-Catholicism in America. He's written a column for the Public Discourse titled The Coming Anti-Catholicism. Dr. Moss, in your piece, you include the following quote, and I'd like to know who said it and why it's important for our discussion. Quote, "It is not bigotry to question whether someone is ill-suited for high office on account of his beliefs. Bigotry presupposes irrational antagonism." Who said that, and why is it important?
Yeah, the who said it is a name that's probably not familiar to most listeners. The author's name is Philip Primeau, and he was writing this in an article for the Catholic World Report. So Primeau and the Catholic World Report are both, you know, on the conservative side of the Catholic spectrum, and I mentioned the quotation for a couple of reasons. One, if you just read the quotation out of context, it sounds exactly like the kind of thing that you would hear coming from the pen or coming from the mouth of a 19th century fundamentalist trying to explain why American citizens should never, ever elect a Catholic to office. You have to consider what they believe. So the same kind of thinking that was used for, you know, two centuries to deny office to Roman Catholics is now being voiced by one who is himself a conservative Roman Catholic. And so that's a kind of a turning point in this essay, that in some respects that there seems to be, in some quarters of the Catholic Church, a kind of return to 19th century ideas, such that they can even play the part of 19th century Protestants in saying, no, we should take very seriously a person's dogma when considering whether or not that person should hold public office.
You say that the intensification of anti-Catholicism has been entirely predictable. Why do you say that?
Yeah, I say that because it's been coming back part and parcel with this movement within Catholicism that is sometimes described as anti-liberal Catholicism or radical Catholicism or Catholic integralism. And although it is a minority position within the Catholic Church, those who hold that position are firmly convinced that this just is the perennial, unreformable position of the Catholic Church. And that position is basically, this is a somewhat simplistic, but it's basically the position that now seems like a caricature, the position believed to be the case by, for example, 19th century fundamentalists. And the position is that, no, there is no separating one's theology and one's religious beliefs from one's politics. And so if one is a Catholic, for example, one has an obligation to advance a Catholic polity or a polity that is preferential to Catholicism. And, of course, that in some ways necessitates a rejection of liberalism in the political sense, the kind of generic traditional political sense, often associated, for example, with the American founding itself, and the idea that people should be at liberty to follow their conscience with respect to religious belief, religious association, and religious expression, and that the state should not try to favor a particular religion, or more especially, to restrict other expressions of religion, so long as they are not, you know, detrimental to the public welfare.
Would you go so far as to call that integralist or that radical approach on the part of some Roman Catholics kind of a Protestants have their dominionism, a Roman Catholic dominionism?
Right. Yeah. No, that's a very good question. And they are, you know, two peas in a pod. So the Reformed dominionism or theonomy does bear a number of resemblances to this radical Catholicism or Catholic integralism. And it's interesting that the Catholic integralism is rising in popularity even when that dominionism and theonomy seems to have, passed its sell-by date. I remember many intense arguments about this in the late 80s and through the 90s, and it's not been on my radar at all over the last decade or so.
I'm thinking about Richard John Neuhaus, and he wrote, a seminal book called Christianity in the Naked Public Square back in 1984. And some people might say, is that what you're talking about? This call by a devout Catholic clergyman for the Christian voice to return to the public square. Would you put Neuhaus in that category?
I would not, although there are some who do attempt kind of revisionist readings of Richard John Neuhaus. Neuhaus, of course, was the founder of the theological journal First Things, which is a journal of, religion and public life. And for many, many years, some of the most prominent writers, including Neuhaus himself, seems to be advocates of the idea that Catholicism and the principles of liberalism, again, broadly and politically understood, namely the principles of the American founding, are entirely compatible. And some people in that kind of First Things camp went even farther to suggest that not only are they compatible, but in a kind of esoteric and not entirely obvious way, America was founded on Catholic principles. And part of that, I don't at all question the sincerity of any of those authors. I think they really believed that. But part of the motivation for advertising this and promoting this did have to do with that kind of lingering American anti-Catholicism. And so a lot of the First Things crowd were very intent on proving to America that Catholics can be good, patriotic American citizens, perhaps even more so than other people. Which makes it all the more curious that over the last 7 or 8 years, First Things has increasingly kind of changed course and come into this radical or integralist camp. And that has led to some debate about, you know, whether or not Niehaus himself can be co-opted for this new movement.
So if you would describe in a little more detail radical Catholicism beyond the bare bones we've discussed here, the integralist approach.
Well, there's some debate about how closely we can align some of these various terms. So, for example, Patrick Deneen, who is a prominent professor at Notre Dame, he I believe, coined the phrase radical Catholicism. And by that, he simply meant a kind of Catholicism that is incompatible with, you know, the philosophical commitments of the American founding. Deneen has been reticent to say what exactly those Catholic principles are that are antithetical to the American founding, and therefore what kind of civic polity might be required by Catholicism. But those who describe themselves as integralists have been much more explicit about, you know, what that might look like. And the basic idea is this. Not all of these principles would I disagree with. So the first principle is simply that the spiritual ends of human beings, namely eternal salvation, are much more important than, you know, the temporal ends of human beings. So spiritual goods are more important than temporal goods. I think any Christian could agree to that. The sort of second step in the integralist argument is that, well, since temporal goods are subordinate to spiritual goods, the temporal order, the political order, ought to be subordinate to the spiritual order, the church. So rather than simply being two distinct realms whose citizens, you know, stand in each, these realms are now related. And the way that they're related is as that of a superior to a subordinate. And then finally, what that means is that on contested questions, the state will be expected to conform to the direction of the church. So, for example, a mid-20th century political philosopher, an entirely sympathetic, describes in the medieval understanding, for example, describes the state as the quote-unquote police arm of the church. So in that medieval context, for example, if one is convicted of heresy, you know, that's the spiritual crime, the church gets to decide who is a heretic and who is not a heretic and excommunicate heretics. But since the church cannot shed blood, the church would then hand the heretic over to the state with the expectation that the state would then punish the heretic with imprisonment or confiscation of property or even execution. So it's that kind of arrangement where the temporal is subordinate to the spiritual, and the spiritual is in some sense sovereign. And for a Catholic integralist, that of course means that at the end of the day, the Catholic Church gets to determine these questions of what are temporal and spiritual goods and how they're to be promoted, protected, and enforced.
We're talking with Dr. Corey Moss about the persistence of anti-Catholicism in America. How has the failure of classical liberalism contributed to the intensification of anti-Catholicism? The answer to that question right after this.
When God decided to love you, he wasn't content to sort of love you at a distance. He wanted to get up close when that happened, which is why Christ took on human flesh.
Pastor Hans Feeney of Lutheran Satire talking about his presentation at the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
But even after Christ ascended to the right hand of the Father, God still wanted to dwell with you through the flesh and blood of his Son. He wanted to be physically present and in the room when he covered you in forgiveness and life and salvation. So that's why he's given his church the Lord's Supper, and that's why we should rejoice every time God comes into the room and invites us to feast on the same flesh and the same blood that won our salvation at Calvary.
You can meet and hear Pastor Hans Feeney making the case for the Lord's Supper at the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, June 7th and 8th in Chicago. Learn more at issuesetc.org.
I believe in the Holy Spirit. Christians confess these words each week during the Divine Service. But have you ever wondered, who is the Holy Spirit? Join Curtis Giese, Jeffrey Oswald, Charles Geeshan, and others in the May issue of the Lutheran Witness as they consider the person and work of the Holy Spirit. Special highlights include a Bible study by Matt Richard and an original Pentecost hymn text by Mark Preuss. Visit cph.org/witness to subscribe today. The Lutheran Witness, interpreting the contemporary world from a Lutheran Christian perspective.
An average of 20 military veterans kill themselves every day. Project Operation Barnabas is a network of LCMS congregations who reach out to veterans and their congregations and their communities with the gospel of Jesus Christ. Operation Barnabas is a program of LCMS Ministry to the Armed Forces. Find out more at lcms.org/armedforces. Serving those who serve. LCMS Ministry to the Armed Forces. lcms.org/armedforces.
Equipping the priesthood of all believers. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Lord, help us ever to retain the catechism's doctrine plain.
What makes a church unique? Perhaps we should ask, what makes a church faithful? Calvary Lutheran Church of Elgin, Illinois, continually learns Christ's doctrine, simply explained in the small catechism. This doctrine teaches us Christ crucified, who even today comes and serves his baptized children in word and sacrament to forgive, strengthen, and teach us for daily life. This, Christ's own work among us, makes and keeps Calvary Lutheran Church faithful. Visit us at clce.org.
The substitute organist service has been a great blessing for our worship life here at Christ the King Lutheran in Riverview, Florida.
Pastor Kevin Yoakum on the substitute organist service.
Now our organ plays rich liturgical music every single Sunday, and it's very affordable. You pick the hymns, you pick the liturgies. It's very simple. Just know when to push play.
You can find out more about the substitute organist service at churchmusicsolutions.com. churchmusicsolutions.com.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about the persistence of anti-Catholicism in America. Dr. Corey Moss is our guest. He's assistant professor of history at Hillsdale College and author of a recent column for the Public Discourse titled The Coming Anti-Catholicism. In the vein of Roman Catholicism, there's a fascinating story told by Andrew Abraham in the latest Online Issues Etc. journal, our Wittenberg Trail feature, titled Treasure Hidden in a Field. He talks about growing up devoutly Roman Catholic, actually becoming a Roman Catholic priest, and then his path to the Lutheran confession and the Lutheran pastorate. You can read it for yourself in the free Online Issues Etc. journal. Subscribe by going to our website, issuesetc.org. Click the red button on the right-hand side. Enter your email address, and we will send you the Online Issues Etc. journal. Dr. Moss, you say that the failure of classical liberalism has contributed to the intensification of anti-Catholicism. How is that?
Yeah, they're very closely intertwined. And Patrick Deneen, whom I mentioned, who first brought attention in a very public way to this kind of radical Catholicism, and perhaps more than most, he has drawn attention to what he simply calls the failure of liberalism. And, I mean, in some respects, it does seem to be the case that this, you know, kind of rosy picture of, you know, of the American founding, where everyone would be, you know, allowed to believe and practice according to their conscience, for example, has failed. And so there's a kind of rethinking. Well, if liberalism hasn't panned out the way we expected it to, you know, if free markets have resulted in a kind of rampant consumerism and greed, if freedom of religious expression has, instead of being freedom of religion, turned into freedom from religion, if the freedom of conscience involves the quote-unquote right to terminate a pregnancy, then liberalism has failed. Something has gone drastically wrong. So we need to go back to the drawing board and think of what might replace that. And for, again, a small minority of Catholics, it was easy for them to recall that, for example, in the 19th century, a series of popes seems to warn against the inevitable failings of liberalism. And so that seems to them a kind of license to say, the Catholic Church knew all along that liberalism was going to fail, and it was going to fail because it's incompatible with the fundamental tenets of Christianity, and especially of the Catholic Church. And so the answer to liberalism's failure is a revival of the pre-liberal and in some respects anti-liberal politics of Christendom.
Is this one side in what you call the intra-Catholic feud?
That is one side. And the other side recognizes that late modern liberalism, the United States and Western Europe, for example, in the year 2019, is going through a crisis. Where they differ is in whether or not that crisis was unavoidable and inevitable because it's baked into the first principles of liberal politics. And the other side in this inter-Catholic feud wants to say no. You know, they want to say that Richard and John Niehaus and the 1990s group of writers at First Things, they were absolutely right that Catholicism and political liberalism are entirely compatible, and in fact that liberalism grows out of the best components of Catholic theology and Catholic thinking about the state. And so these are the kinds of Catholics that we associate with the Alliance Defending Freedom or the Becket Society or Public Discourse, and some of these venues that are doing their best to protect religious expression, not only Catholic but also Lutheran and Muslim, not only because they think that this is what American politics requires, the American Constitution requires, but because they think this is in absolute harmony with what the Church, the Catholic Church, and most Christian churches teach about rights of conscience and the freedom of religious expression. So the intra-Catholic debate comes down to the question of, is Catholicism compatible with political liberalism, or is it not? And if it is, how do we fix some of the defects of late modern liberalism? And if Catholicism is simply not compatible with any kind of liberalism, where do we go from here? And many of the suggestions to date seem to imply that the where we go from here is a return to a kind of medieval church-state integration, including many of the negative things associated with that, or at least associated with that by non-Catholics. So prescriptions on freedom of religion and religious expression for non-Catholics, even up to and including, as one author has recently been bold enough to make public, the possibility of executing people for heresy.
Will this intra-Catholic feud make our society's apparent comfort level with anti-Catholicism better or worse?
Unfortunately, I think it can only make people more comfortable with anti-Catholicism. I have to think, and again, this is the kind of historical angle, I have to think that when 19th century fundamentalist Protestants were running around saying, we can't let the Catholics have power, otherwise they're going to suppress our religion and burn us at the stake, when 21st century Catholics in print and elsewhere say, we need to gain power so that we can suppress non-Catholics and perhaps even burn them at the stake, that's only going to revive the kind of prejudices of a previous era. With this difference, if you can point to 21st century Catholics saying this is what they desire and what they intend, it becomes increasingly difficult to think of those as prejudices. We're not prejudging what Catholicism might mean for the state. We're simply pointing to what some very vocal, although still a minority, of Catholics are saying and writing. So I think it will make anti-Catholicism much more prevalent and arguably much more defensible.
The difference, of course, as you pointed out earlier in our conversation, is that much of the anti-Catholicism in the 21st century is coming from the secular left rather than from Protestant fundamentalism. And how does that change the equation?
Well, it changes the equation, perhaps most importantly, for any listeners who do not happen to be Catholic themselves, but happen to be some other, religious persuasion. It changes the equation in this way. To the extent that Catholicism gets a black eye or a bad name in the public square, that will inevitably be increasingly imputed to other non-Catholic Christians. And this is in some ways where we began. So insofar as relatively uninformed public figures might think that the abortion issue is a uniquely Catholic issue, they might be described as anti-Catholic, and they might even think of themselves as anti-Catholic. But since it turns out to be the case that it's not only Catholics who have a real moral objection to abortion, but most Christians, then that quote-unquote anti-Catholicism becomes broadened to an anti-Christian sentiment. And we could see the same even if, for example, a Lutheran does not share the same political ideas as certain Catholics might, to the extent that it becomes increasingly known and increasingly evident that this group of Christians, these integralists or radical Catholics, are attempting to speak for Catholicism as a whole. There might be a temptation to say, perhaps they're speaking for Christianity as a whole. And, other Christians are just, being sneaky and not advertising what their political agenda is. So I would not be surprised if an increased anti-Catholicism were followed by an even more expansive anti-Christian sentiment.
How would you respond to a Roman Catholic listener who says, I really want no truck with the radical Catholic ideas or with the integralist approach, but our bigger problem, of course, is that we do have politicians in power with real exercise of power for whom their Catholicism means nothing. They are
right.
Catholic in name only, and even the church seems powerless to call them to account, even in an ecclesiastical sense, powerless or perhaps unwilling to exercise its rightful ecclesiastical authority over them as individual Catholic parishioners?
Right. That's a really good question. And this has been pointed out by many of the critics of radical Catholicism or integralism. Namely, how can anyone take seriously the proposal that Catholicism or the Catholic hierarchy is going to clean up the mess that is 21st century temporal politics when they can't even get their own house in order? Whether that is disciplining priests who are directly answerable to bishops and ultimately the Pope, but even prominent Catholic politicians who advertise their Catholicism, but who almost down the line are vocally opposed to the tenets of the faith. So I don't know what to say to that other than to, in some respects, to breathe a sigh of relief that an integralist Catholic order is probably not going to appear any time in my lifetime, seeing as that they can't even keep their own parishioners towing the line. But on the other hand, this is a concern. There are ways, and I think quite obviously good ways and necessary ways, that one's faith informs one's thinking about temporal goods and politics more broadly. And there ought to be room in the public square to discuss that, but it's not helped by people who claim to hold a particular theological affiliation but who oppose everything that, that the church stands for. It, it makes it more difficult to evaluate what ideas might be good for our common life together and what ideas might not be.
We're talking with Dr. Corey Maas about the persistence of anti-Catholicism in America. I once heard an older Lutheran pastor say, well, the Roman Catholic Church is like the dike, and the rest of us are like the little village. If they go, we all go. We'll see what Dr. Maas thinks about that after this. Nadia Bolz Weber calls for a sexual reformation in her latest book, Shameless. How does her reformation compare with the truths rediscovered during the 16th century Reformation? I've written a review of Shameless in the latest Issues Etc. journal. We'll send it to you for free. Just click the red journal subscription button on the right-hand column at issuesetc.org. In the Wittenberg Trail feature, Pastor Andrew Abraham details his journey from Catholic priest to Lutheran pastor. The free online Issues Etc. journal.
Our cities are some of the greatest mission fields on the planet, but the footprint of the church is shrinking. We dare not shrink from our cities. Christ is needed now in our urban areas. From chaos, turmoil, decay, death, and destruction, Jesus brings peace, hope, resurrection, eternal life, and rebuilding. And you can help by being a hero for the city. Find out how at lcms.org/citymission or on Facebook at LCMS City Mission. Every city needs a hero. Capes and helmets not required.
Where Christianity meets culture, you're listening to Issues Etc.
Lutheran Federal Credit Union was formed to serve you and to serve the church. During May, when you open a Lutheran FCU loan to meet your financial needs, or when you use your Lutheran FCU credit card for a qualifying amount of purchases, Lutheran FCU will give you cash back and give that same amount of money to their ministry of the month, Dakota Boys and Girls Ranch. Learn more at LutheranFCU.org. Lutheran FCU, good for you, good for the church. LutheranFCU.org.
Give your mom the gift of a clean home for Mother's Day with a gift certificate from The Cleaning Authority. Gift certificates can be purchased for as little as $75 for a partial clean. Go to gifts.thecleaningauthority.com, enter your contact information, and choose the amount. Give the gift of time for your mom with a Mother's Day gift certificate from The Cleaning Authority. Gifts.thecleaningauthority.com. Gifts.thecleaningauthority.com.
Welcome back. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. Dr. Corey Maas of Hillsdale College is our guest. We're talking about the persistence of anti-Catholicism in America. Dr. Maas, I had a conversation years ago with an older Lutheran pastor, and he made this observation. We were talking about the life issue, abortion and the life issue, and he said, thank God for the Roman Catholics. If they go, we all go. They're like the dike that's holding back the floodwaters, and the rest of us non-Catholics are like the little village there on the dry side. If they go, we go. What are your thoughts there?
No, I think there's quite a lot to that. I think it's perhaps not quite so dire in empirical terms. So, for example, there have been a lot of reports recently that in America, for example, on the life issue especially, and more particularly, specifically the abortion issue, it is now American evangelicals who make up the, you know, the largest body of protesters, policy influencers, think tankers, and that the influence on the ground of rank-and-file Roman Catholics has greatly diminished. Now, on the other hand, you know, the number of people standing on the corner outside of Planned Parenthood does not at all reflect, you know, influence in, for example, the press. And so it is concerning when the most visible and largest ecclesial body, the Roman Catholic Church, seems to waffle on some of these important issues, because it gives the impression that, well, if even the Catholic Church can't be taken seriously on this, or if even the Catholic Church isn't going to push back against this, then we have nothing to worry about, and we can, you know, full speed ahead with our agenda. And so I for one, am, you know, absolutely ecstatic that there are, and I, as I indicated before, you know, largely the majority of American Catholics are still firmly committed to, you know, the First Amendment and free exercise of religion, and are defending that in the courts. And if all of them simply took their ball and went home tomorrow, we non-Catholics would be in a much more tenuous position. We don't get to the press. We don't have the prestige, and we're not taken as seriously for those reasons as the Catholic Church is.
Another idea occurs to me, and I guess it strikes me that we've had this entire conversation on anti-Catholicism in the 21st century without mentioning the priestly abuse scandal. And I don't want to throw you a curveball, but do you think that that will prove a major contributor to the future of anti-Catholicism?
I think there's a very real possibility that this is the case. And it's, you know, it's part and parcel of, you know, the public visibility of the Catholic Church. You know, as many Catholics themselves have pointed out, you know, the Catholic Church does not have a monopoly on sexual abuse. It can be found in all churches. It can be found in public schools. But because the Catholic Church is such a large institution, and because of the kind of institution it is, a Christian church, it, of course, is taking a public beating in a way that other churches and other institutions are not. And for that reason, I think some anti-Catholic sentiment has increased, is increasing, and will continue to increase, not simply because of incidences of abuse, but more pointedly because of the way the hierarchy has or has not dealt with that abuse. You know, to the extent that it appears that the temporal good of protecting children has taken a backseat to protecting the spiritual good of priestly authority, that can and will give the impression that the church cannot be trusted to oversee or perhaps even participate in the temporal governance of society.
What can non-Catholics do to argue against anti-Catholicism?
Well, I think one of the things we should do is do what, again, the majority of Catholics themselves do, and insist that there does have to be a distinction between the two realms. And so there is a tendency to mock, is perhaps not quite the right word, But to look down on John F. Kennedy for making that public-private distinction. What's kind of been lost in that is that Amy Coney Barrett, who, you know, although she was given grief because the dogma lives loudly within her, in some of her writings she had taken exactly that same position, indicating that, you know, if I were to be a judge on a, you know, superior court or even perhaps on the Supreme Court, I would have to judge in accordance with the Constitution of the United States, not in accordance with, you know, the Catechism of the Catholic Church. And so there's, you know, there's something intuitive, perhaps especially for a Lutheran, perhaps especially for an American, in making that distinction. And that's what many Catholics and non-Catholics alike have said when Amy Coney Barrett got pushback, or when Brett Kavanaugh got questions about his Catholicism. They emphasized that, no. We have to judge a person's qualifications for public office by how well he can perform that office, not by what he or she believes about the nature of God or, you know, what's happening in the sacraments. Those are not immediately applicable. Now, there are always going to be exceptions and qualifications. Someone belongs to a sect or cult that thinks child sacrifice is a good thing, we're probably all going to have second thoughts about whether or not we want to elect him to a legislative body to make laws that might impinge on that question.
Finally then, Dr. Moss, in your situation there at Hillsdale College, you are surrounded by Roman Catholic, very serious Roman Catholic colleagues.
Yes.
Do you sense from them concern about anti-Catholicism today?
Some. Honestly, the concern that I hear more frequently expressed is a concern about their fellow Catholics who are anti-liberal. So these radical Catholics or these integralists, their concern is that this minority of vocal radical Catholics is giving the wrong impression, or at the very least, an incredibly unhelpful impression of what Catholicism entails and what its implications might be for public order and for politics. And so they're very concerned, many of them, very concerned with the increasing popularity of this Catholic anti-liberalism. And so I suppose, I don't want to throw any of them under the bus, but I suppose that they might be, you know, described as falling at least partly into that earlier era of First Things, Richard John Niehaus, and the idea that Catholicism is compatible with the best of the American tradition and the principles of the American founding. And so any attempt by Catholics or non-Catholics to revive the picture of Catholicism as a dangerous political despotism is only going to be bad for Catholicism.
Dr. Corey Moss is assistant professor of history at Hillsdale College and author of a recent column for the Public Discourse titled The Coming Anti-Catholicism. Read it for yourself at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Dr. Moss, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks so much for having me.
In Hour 2 of Issues Etc., we are going to go to the mailbag, our listener's email, and the Issues Etc. comment line and respond to as much of it as we can. We'll be right back.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.